Hello, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremen.
And I'm Lara Chan Baker.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group, which is a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. What originally started as a business conference for artists and fellow creatives is now being turned around to shine a light on our clients. From art buyers and creative teams to fellow producers and managers, this podcast is all about offering a glimpse into the work we do as the bridge between clients and creatives. It's an ongoing exploration of how to wrangle the creative process to achieve excellence no matter what the medium. Today, we get animated to talk about animation. For Jackie Winter, it's been one of the fastest growing sectors of our business and represents a whole new scale of challenges for our producers and our artists. We'll cover everything from what makes a good animation brief, as well as give a bit of a top level overview of our process, joined by our special guest in the studio, creative director of our Flutter branch, Dom Bartolo, as well as some things to look out for specific to the medium. But first, how is everyone going? Lara, how are you?
I'm good. I'm doing a talk panel thing tonight, and I'm a little bit nervous. My presentation has lots of dumb GIFs in it.
You've been killing it on the presentations. We've been doing all of our kind of open tabs events, which have been going really well.
But I enjoy having a
stage,
a room full of people who are forced to listen to me.
For anyone who hasn't checked that out, go to opentabs.rodeo if you want us to bring one of our events to your agency in the new year. I think we're pretty much booked up for now. But yeah, it's been great. Great event. B, how are you?
I am fantastic. I took a couple of days off over Thanksgiving recently, and I just moved into a new apartment, so I'm feeling very refreshed and nice and settled, and I am ready to go. I'm ready
Excellent.
To get moving. How are you, Jeremy?
was that an animation pun?
Yeah, that was a dad joke. I'm not a dad, though.
So before we get started, let's go through some of the mini links that have been going through our professional development Slack. And I think very relevant to the topic at hand is a piece from Motionographer. B, tell us a bit about this and why you responded to that.
Yeah, I mean, this is one that you posted on our professional development Slack, but it's called Growing a Business the Hard Way. And it's an article on one of my favorite motion websites, Motionographer, by James Chambers, who is the co-founder of an animation production company called Animade and also a storyboarding app called Boards. And he kind of posted just a bit of an insight into kind of like how they grew their company and the product that they also provide as well, Boards. And his motivation was kind of to share what's worked and what hasn't for both of those companies in the hope that it will, I guess, make someone else's life easier or just give some insights into the highs and lows, because sometimes we're always only seeing the highs and the highlight reel of, you know, people being successful in whatever it is that they do. And I think this was my favorite thing of everything that I read this week, only because I resonated with it. I mean, moving here to New York from Melbourne last year to set up and grow our North American office, which has been kind of no easy feat. It was just comforting to read how business, you know, similar sort of in size to ours, has approached scale and staffing. And there was one thing that I really liked in the article, which was their very simple approach to documenting their processes through what they call playbooks. And they give an example of a couple of sections of their marketing playbook that they use in their animation studio, which, I mean, it's not anything too groundbreaking, but I guess what I really liked about it was the simplicity. You know, I can get wrapped up in complexity at times. And, you know, as someone who's one of several agents at Jackie Winter that is responsible for managing our roster of artists, it is important that all of our processes are consistent. So, you know, our clients and artists are getting a consistent level of service. However, we do deal with such a broad range of artists, clients, projects, and mediums that it can be difficult to kind of document and capture all of the nuances. So it was a nice little reminder to kind of just maybe sometimes keep it stupid simple.
Yeah, it's a really minor point, but the whole idea of documenting processes is something that, yeah, we kind of do that a bit in Evernote, which is a bit kind of less organized, but I love how they break that down. I thought that's a good way to kind of handle delegating in terms of taking it out of your brain and kind of putting it out there on paper so someone else can do it. I also just love Boards and what Animade is doing as well in terms of a production company kind of starting their own product, which is, yeah, something I think we'll talk about a bit more hopefully in the future.
A little tiny quote that I found over the week was from Lecture in Progress, which is an initiative from the Clever Folk at It's Nice That, which it's an educational platform to try and bridge the gap between design education and the design industry. You know, that looks like a really interesting resource. It's a paid resource, so I haven't really delved too deeply into that, considering I'm not actually a design student or a creative student. But there was this nice little quote from the artist Noma Bar, which I thought really nicely sums up the role of an agent. And that was, a good agent should be a manager, a therapist, a problem solver, and a friend.
I think those are some of the exact same words we used in our agent episode. But yeah, Noma is one of my, I think he's just one of the greats at the moment. Everyone has probably seen his work in some regard. And yeah, Lecture in Progress is a really interesting platform. Again, I haven't kind of seen anything because I haven't paid for it yet. But I mean, I don't know if I'm kind of the target audience, but yeah, it's definitely something interesting to check out, if not for this article, but for the whole platform itself. Next up is a piece that was very close to my heart that I had to put up there, which is Meet the People Who Listen to Podcasts at Super Fast Speeds. And I know I get a lot of flack for this at the moment.
Yeah, because it's the worst.
No, it's not the worst. I defend it completely. So I'm at around 2x, and this comes to people who, I think someone is doing it at 2.8x.
People are painstakingly crafting these shows for you, and you're just stomping all over the creative.
Well, this is what I like about the art. I mean, this is a good article. I think it does bring up the fact that, yeah, there is so much content and people have such limited time, this way that they kind of get it in. And I feel like, yes, if anyone kind of reads this piece, maybe they get a bit of a greater understanding, of where I'm coming from here. But also, yeah, I think they are defending those more kind of crafted pieces in terms of not speeding them up. But yeah, I really enjoy this piece. It's I was so nice to know that there are other people like me. But yeah, my weapon of choice for podcasts is Overcast, which basically allows you from go to 0 to 3x, but it also cuts out the silences as well, and it gives you kind of variable kind of speed that kind of goes up and down to really kind of maximize it. So yeah.
On so many podcasts, the silences are such a key part of the story. It's those pauses, that look, I just can't even, Jeremy.
Our podcast sounds great at 2x. It's like, oh,
we
man.
We sound insane. We
Does
talk
everyone
so fast
sound like
anyway.
A chipmunk?
No, it doesn't change the pitch. It only changes the speed. Very different thing.
I refuse.
Laura,
would you ever watch a movie at 2x?
Now we're getting into deeper discussions, but there is actually a hack that people have taken to Netflix as well, because you can't adjust the speed in Netflix, where you can kind of speed everything up, just by I think 0.1%. So it's like, if you're binge watching 8 hours, it'll kind of wipe an hour off it, basically, which is pretty good if you're, trying to manage your time effectively.
I guess it's like someone going to a restaurant and stuffing their face really quickly, or taking time to kind of enjoy the meal.
Yeah,
and
to actually enjoy it as it was intended to be enjoyed.
Anyway, Laura, dilly dilly,
which I had to Google this morning because I, anyway, dilly dilly. HQ quiz app. We are pretty obsessed here in the office.
Thank you to Nirmala, our previous guest, for putting us onto it.
During her interview on our show, she mentioned this, and ever since we've been glued. For anyone who doesn't know what HQ is, it's basically a live trivia app that you can play twice a day. You play for real money with real people around the world, and it's live hosted by this guy who's become really the face of the app, Scott Rogowski. It's
dangerous.
And I have kind of... I didn't like him at first, and now I just adore him. I love Scott Rogowski. I just want more Scott Rogowski. But this crazy thing happened recently where poor Scott, so the Daily Beast wanted to do a pretty lighthearted profile on him and his sort of weird fame from this bizarre app. And also, just to say, there's 300,000 people that play every time the game goes live. It's really crazy. But basically, Daily Beast wanted to do this interview. They asked him some very sort of gentle nothing questions, and then they emailed the CEOs of HQ just to give them a heads up that the interview was going live. And then they got this absolutely insane call from the CEO, basically threatening that he was going to fire Scott if they released the interview. And they shared the interview saying no, look, it's just him saying he likes salad and saying how great the app is and really positive. And again, he was just threatening, do you want Scott to lose his job? How can you do this? And so instead of running this profile, they turn the piece into an article about how insane the CEO is and all of the crazy things that he threatened. But we will post the link to that article because it's so bizarre and so good. And poor Scott.
Oh, it's such an amazing read. I don't know if Scott is not being held against his will in HQ, but yeah, it's definitely
I love
worth-
it. Although what I can't get around is everyone calling him Quiz Daddy. It's not good.
Yeah, definitely. Lorelai, my partner, has an affection for Scott that is kind of, bordering on tampering, our relationship. But just I'm looking the other way at the moment. Okay, thank you very much. Let's move on. Well, it's taken us nearly half a year to get here, but we're finally ready to sit down and have a serious heart-to-heart talk about animation. For us here at Jackie Winter, through our Flutter and GiveHorse branches, making things move accounts for more and more of our workflow each year. As more screens fill more places, brands and publishers and everyone in between need more content to put on those screens, and this is exactly where we come in. For our artists and our producers, working on animated content can be one of the most rewarding tasks there is, but it's not without its unique production challenges. To that end, we thought we'd have a bit more of a process-driven chat today and talk about how animation differs from some of the other projects we work on and some specific skills required as creative producers to help navigate them. I think we're all going to kind of go around the table and kind of talk about some specific aspect to animation, including a very special guest here in the studio, Dom Bartolo, our creative director and co-founder of Flutter, as well as our partners in Animation 2119. Hi, Dom. How are you going?
I'm good. Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks so much for coming. So I thought maybe for those of you, I mean, I think most producers at this point will have some kind of experience in animation. I mean, I think it's interesting how it's kind of gone from TV departments out to kind of, I guess, more a bit of a broader spectrum of art buyer or producer, especially with at our clients at agencies. But I thought we'd do a bit of a kind of overview of the different production models that are out there at the moment, and then kind of talk about how what we do, kind of where that kind of fits in, just to put everything in context. And Dom, yeah, you might have some kind of areas to chime in here, because there's so many kind of different ways of doing things at the moment that are really kind of changing from year to year. Another really interesting part of this conversation I haven't kind of talked about as well is that, you know, Bianca, her kind of, initial experience as well has been...
I've been doing animation for 10 years. It's very close to my heart. I was like kind of thinking about it today. And I do remember being quite young and really loving like 2D animation and kind of wanting to be an animator, which is crazy. And I think that's why I got into... like I studied multimedia design in the first place in this sort of roundabout way, because there's absolutely no way that I would actually be able to animate myself. But there was always something that I think I really enjoyed about the medium, especially when it's kind of 2D cell animation. So yeah, I mean, I've kind of built my entire career off animation.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know if I spoke to you guys about this as well, but my dad actually went to school for animation, and he was a cameraman.
He never told me.
Yeah, he was a camera operator for an animated film called Tubby the Tuba, which I think was like a pretty decently big one.
Yes.
That's a thing. Yeah, it is a thing. Anyway, that's been another really interesting thing to come out of our interview series in terms of how much, people's early and family experiences kind of get them on the career path they are today. But that's a story for another time. But maybe actually that kind of segues nicely into, the different kind of production models, because Bianca, the studio that you were at was, I guess, pretty representative of what the kind of standard model is in terms of, I guess, an in-house animation studio where kind of everyone is kind of sits there kind of under one roof, where you kind of have, you have an executive producer and creative director and then kind of animators who are kind of working there. Can you talk to us a bit more kind of about that structure be? Just give us a really kind of top line breakdown.
Yeah, I mean, where I started my career was more of a typical animation production company where you did have an executive producer that was kind of there to try and go out and win work and, win over clients and be really involved in the sort of top line pitching. But you also, I mean, the studio that I was at had a roster of about 6 or 7 animation directors that were kind of scattered around the world, and they would pitch on various projects. But then we also had an in-house team of producers, me being one of them, and some sort of more technical crew, like a head of 3D, someone that was in charge of the render farm and the pipeline, and then sort of more style frame illustrators, art directors, and then I guess depending on the project that was on and the style of animation, because it generally moved from being 2D to 3D to sort of like quite more like high-end visual effects, we would bring in freelancers depending on the project that was on at hand. But that was a pretty typical kind of like animation studio model. And then kind of on top of that, we were also represented by a production company in the US who would also try and find us work within that market. So there was an added layer of representation on top of that.
Yeah, it's really interesting just how the kind of freelance economy works in motion graphics. I mean, we were talking about with Brendan last week, for example, about, you know, how people who work on kind of live action, it's just kind of this crazy, you know, carnival of people just kind of getting picked up for different kind of gigs here and there and kind of everywhere. And that's what I think was interesting about your experience there. I thought that studio was quite unique in terms of how they had kind of in-house talent, but then they also kind of represented talent, and then they were also kind of represented as well. So a real kind of interesting kind of hybrid model there. And I guess that's kind of, even though people are always kind of being brought on at for different things in a project, like different kind of specialties, that's kind of this, I guess those are the two different models. We have the model where, you know, artists are kind of working in-house and designers are kind of there bringing people in as needed, but then you have the bigger kind of production companies as well that kind of just represent either individual directors, and then those directors kind of bring people on kind of, you know, depending on kind of the script or kind of what's needed. So I would say, I mean, those are the two major models. Don, do you have anything to add there that I've kind of, that I might have missed at all?
Well, I think the semantics of like animation kind of bring up different models, because people talk about moving image, they talk about broadcast design, they talk about film, animation, motion design, motion graphics, what's the difference, you know? And you then have all these different company models that kind of represent those strands of work. I began at a broadcast design company where it was filled with designers who were motion designers. So everybody was responsible for, you know, developing their projects from the ground up, producing the art and directing them and then animating them themselves. But I think, yeah, the bigger the projects and the greater the ambition, the more natural desire there is to bring in additional hands to kind of build the kind of architecture of what you're dreaming up. So I think that's kind of the common denominator for all work, no matter what the kind of production model is that the larger the scale of work, the more people inherently are involved. And I love that old adage about theatre, because that's what animation is. It's theatre. And, you know, theatre really is a collaborative art.
Mm. And I guess that was a real kind of inspiration for how then we kind of developed Flutter, which I mean, I think I'm not going to toot our own horn here, but I do think it's quite a different kind of model where, you know, when we wanted to kind of move into animation, we kind of said like, well, you know, we have all these amazing artists and they're not all animators, but they're incredible artists in their own right. And a lot of kind of campaigns were kind of were becoming more fully integrated in terms of, you know, clients would start with a print campaign and then want animated content from there. So that's kind of how, you know, me and you, Dom, kind of came together there, which was like, well, let's kind of invert the model of a production company where, okay, we represent a few directors and those people kind of pull things in from there where, okay, well, we start with the artist. We always kind of start with the actual kind of aesthetic and then, you know, use them as the kind of linchpin. And then the kind of team, you know, builds around there with the 2119 team acting as kind of our, you know, our animators and creative directors and everything else from there. So that's been a really interesting process. And then we have Gift Horse as well, which is kind of something that almost was a response to the work that we were doing with Flutter, where I guess we were seeing much more of a request for artists who are animating themselves to produce much more kind of shorter form content, which doesn't require the full kind of expertise, or not expertise, the full kind of overhead of those larger kind of projects that we're kind of looking at as well. So yeah, that's kind of how we've developed kind of our offerings in kind there. And I think we're seeing, you know, just harking back to the Animate offering as well, like, you know, people are finding alternative ways to develop income or develop, you know, their own expertise and processes in-house to develop new businesses. And yeah, that's what we kind of have done here. So Laura, I think, you know, one of the first things that we touched upon in the podcast is, you know, what makes kind of a good brief. And I think a lot of the things, you know, we were talking about there were more to do with kind of static illustration briefs. And as we've kind of gone into more kind of specialized episodes here, whether it's kind of installation work or live work, for example, you know, we've talked about the specific things that have to be kind of tailored or taken into account. And definitely like Dom was using the analogy of theater before, obviously anytime you get onto kind of bigger projects, a lot different types of things need to be taken into account. So tell us a bit more from a producer's perspective, what needs to be in an animation brief and how does it kind of differ from a traditional illustration or design brief?
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously a lot of stuff does carry across in the briefing process from illustration to animation to installation, whatever it might be. You know, there are always basic things that you need, like, you know, what is it? Style references, timings, etc. You know, and that's true across any and all creative projects. And we've looked at this stuff before, as you said, so I won't repeat it all, but there are definitely a few things that are specific to an animation brief or just ever more important with an animation brief. So we'll look at a few of those. I think firstly, and often where we start is, you know, looking at the purpose of the piece and how it's going to be used. So, you know, animations might be created for TV commercials or cinema ads or online pre-rolls or internal corporate explainer videos, music videos, social media content, whatever else. And each of these requires different specs, like the resolutions or file formats or aspect ratios or size restrictions and so on. So having that understanding up front of how the animation will be used can sort of quickly put that brief into context for you and help sort of guide the rest of your fact finding. So also, this sounds super simple, but as all of us in this room and in that room in New York know quite well, that can be easily missed. It's just, how many final animations do they actually require? I think especially when a client is spending a very large amount of money on a big animated piece, it's quite likely that they're going to want to see it or want to be able to use it rather across multiple channels. That means that there's likely to be cut downs or different endings required. And I guess it's quite crucial to get an understanding of exactly what they're expecting to receive at the end.
And the tech is changing so much. I mean, we haven't even gotten into kind of formats as well.
But exactly. Like, and all of those things take time and that can create pretty major headaches during a project if it's not resolved up front. And then number two sort of major thing I'd say is the script. Without a script or storyboards, it's pretty difficult to provide anything more concrete than a sort of very loose ballpark. And that can complicate things, I guess.
But sometimes as well, like, you know, we'll kind of come in a more kind of creative perspective and kind of, and, you know, write a script kind of with our clients or kind of develop it in conjunction. But totally. It's whether or not, like, kind of, yeah, people want to engage a studio kind of like that.
Yeah. I mean, we need to bring people in who, I guess Dom as well would help write scripts and things, but that's another ball game. I mean, but I think, again, until we have that script sorted, we still don't know how much the actual project is going to take to make, you know. But yeah, I guess it's sort of important to note that there is obviously quite some difference in complexity between a script that sort of follows a single character through a single environment compared to something that, you know, where you have a number of characters going through a whole lot of different environments and different sort of complex transitions. And then, you know, I guess often the client themselves doesn't necessarily have an understanding of what might make a project more complex or more simple than another. So by giving us the script, it can often be the quickest way for us to get a really good overview of what that piece requires without them having to have that innate understanding themselves.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's really interesting because, yeah, we've worked on so many animated projects and, like, you know, sometimes like animation isn't something that most studios kind of do every day, even though they might be doing live action. And sometimes it can be dangerous when you take that live action mindset and try to apply it to an animation brief. Because the first, when we talk about, okay, what's making a good brief, it's really, I mean, you have to kind of flip that question around in terms of, well, what's going to get you the most accurate price as quick as possible? Because when people come to us, that's what they want. They want to know just how much is it going to cost.
Absolutely.
And it's like there are so many kind of moving parts. And as we were talking about kind of structures before, like you, every time you want to kind of do something different, might be bringing a different specialist in or might be kind of doing something different. And, you know, but that is, there's a huge range of scales now between, like, well, if it purpose is one of the most important things, like, is it a 5-second thing that you're only going to see in a very kind of small screen? Do you really need to do it this way? Or are you trying to kind of,
or is it going to be across thousands of cinema screens across the country for 6 months?
I'd interject with one thing that I always think is hugely important in a brief, which is the ambition of a project. What is the ambition? When I say ambition, I mean specifically, I think clients are often in a position with animation to dictate a production budget. And, you know, production budgets for me really kind of establish the ambition of a project because we all know that anything is possible in animation. And the real limit to a production is the resources at your disposal. And you can, you know, throw as many people at it as you can afford, really, or you can spend as much time as you're willing to invest. And I think ambition is often one of those gray areas that's undefined with projects, but it's a great area to needle down on at the beginning of a project because really it sets you up to understand the full undertaking. And, you know, I actually prefer those projects where we establish that up front so that we can perfectly tailor and push to the limit the most out of those resources.
Because I guess like any creative project, unless you understand what you're hoping to get out of it, I mean, it's really hard to create the right thing. So that's very, totally. Very true. And then I guess just sort of continuing on with, you know, just the other things on the list of sort of the standard brief and how they might differ with animation. I mean, there's style, of course. It's always sort of the big one. And I mean, on any project, of course, it's very vital to have an understanding of the visual direction. But I think the cost and the timing implications of different styles in an animation project can be really enormous. So and also just to clarify, when I'm talking about style here, I think we're talking about both the actual visual aesthetic as well as the style of the animation itself. So like the way that it moves. So for example, like a visual style that relies really heavily on handcrafted assets might be a bit more like labor intensive and technically challenging to produce in motion than something that is achieved with sort of very simple vector shapes, or something executed purely in After Effects will be much more cost effective than something executed in 3D or involving VFX and live action production. And then you've got stop motion is another beast altogether. And I think it's really important to have a sort of benchmark in play here. And then another thing to clarify with any sort of video-based project is who's going to be responsible for looking after the sound.
So overlooked. And often
so overlooked. I can admit I've overlooked it before. And lucky it's never blown up in my face, but it definitely could. I think often we work with a lot of really large advertising agencies who do regularly sort of commission motion content. And in those cases, they do often have a preferred sound house that they work with to sort of produce any required audio. But in some cases, and particularly when you're working with people who are sort of newer to producing motion work or who don't commission this kind of work too often, then they might be looking for more of a sort of like one-stop shop and wanting us to look after the sound and VO and music production. As you said, it's really definitely something that can be so easily forgotten in that initial briefing process when everyone's just so excited about the visual. And then you sort of get halfway through the project and you sort of realize that the client was expecting you to produce a sound and you were waiting on them to send through the files. And
the key thing about music is that it really makes or breaks a project. I mean, you can have phenomenal music and it will elevate a project, and then if you get crap music or crap VO production, it really brings something down. And we talked before about how people got into this industry. I mean, I was listening to music and wanted to bring that to life, and I think music carries all the emotion for a project. So it's really one of those things
that's so important.
It has to be,
nailed. Yeah, it can often be sort of, part of the brief in that you are sometimes building the animation to fit, with the tone of the music and the pacing of the music. And it can be quite a key.
That's a big point element. In terms of references as well. Sorry to interrupt, but in terms of, we love getting visual reference when we're doing an illustration brief or anything else, but getting motion reference as well, not for aesthetic, but for pacing, because that's like, that's the fourth dimension. It's
tempo.
All about kind of timing, exactly, that whole tempo,
and reference for audio.
Yeah,
exactly. My favorite analogy for animation without music or VO is like asking someone to dance in a silent room. It's ridiculous. You can't really do any animation without music or VO.
You've obviously never been to a great silent disco.
Have you, Jeremy? I cannot watch films on a plane because the audio quality for me just is awful. So I do not enjoy watching films on a plane just for that reason.
I don't like watching films on a plane because I get very emotional. I've cried.
It's true. I get really emotional.
I watched Silence of the Lambs on a long haul flight once when everyone was in their like fake nighttime sleep, and it was just such a bad.
Look, I watched Dance Academy the movie and I had a little bit of a cry.
One thing that we're seeing a lot more of is animation for social content as well, which is coming with very demanding kind of schedules. Is there a difference or kind of something that you like to see in the briefing process for those kind of jobs that you think we haven't covered off at all?
I think for social, Lara's touched on earlier that, a lot of these different mediums that we're working in have different technical specs, and social media is, it just kind of opens up a new sort of can of worms and a new sort of set of challenges and technical considerations rather than when you're working for TV. Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat, they all present content in different ways, and they all often have very strict guidelines for action safe areas and how copy can actually be displayed. And
I thought we were over the kind of like action safe, title
no,
safe
not
stuff.
For Facebook.
No. When we left like 4:3 TV and like went to 16:9, it was fully embraced. I was like, yes, it's now over. We don't have to worry about it. And then social media like brought it all.
Yeah. Then Facebook came back, and I think the other limitation is on file size, and that can really affect the complexity of actually what you can create and what you can animate in the
Completely.
Yeah like the level
oh, especially
of complexity.
When I've had like GIF briefs for like banner ads and stuff, and then like right at the end they're like, oh, by the way, it can only be like 2 kilobytes,
like,
and you're like,
web design for 1999, like, it really is. Limited color palettes.
I also just, like, I don't know, I think it's important to touch again on what Dom sort of mentioned briefly, that sort of big awkward elephant in the room, the budget, you know, because I think, and Dom, you and I have talked about this so many times with, like, you know, the thing with animation projects is that there's often such a lot to still be worked out in terms of the narrative and the style and direction when things are at that briefing stage. And because animation is such a complex beast, shifts in any of those things can change the budget quite significantly. So it is really sort of crucial to have an understanding of those budget parameters that you need to work within so that you can guide the creative accordingly. And I think often there's such a hesitation to put any sort of number forward because no one wants to show their cards too soon. But I think the thing is, and kind of the beauty of animation is that there are so many more variables than with a static illustration, and that, you know, gives you room to find the best combination of elements or the best compromises to bring things to life awesomely, but like within those necessary limits. What do you
totally.
Think,
Tom? Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, there's the you know, old saying is put the money on the screen, so to speak. And, you know, you really want to take control of that budget and devise a strategy for allocating that across the project so that it fully comes to life. And, you know, where you might be able to cheat one aspect of a job and perform something in a really modest way, you can then afford to kind of invest it in another more elaborate technique. It's all that fine balancing act. And I think part of that problem solving is what people come to us for, is to kind of go, okay, we've got this amount. Let's see how we can develop this project and make the most out of
it. Totally. And I think that's when you sort of become what I like anyways, when you come with sort of one big production team with the client where you're all sort of aware of what the budget is, aware of what all the limits are, and you're all trying to solve that creative problem together rather than you just being this like distant supplier and they won't want to sort of show you anything behind the scenes. And yeah, that makes it quite tricky. I guess the last thing I wanted to touch on just in terms of briefing was treatments. I mean, it's pretty common, you know, at least with like larger animation projects, that there will be a pitch treatment required before a project is awarded to anyone. So, you know, in those cases, you really want to know what the client is expecting from a treatment and like when they need it. That seems really simple, but it's true. And, you know, sometimes they're only wanting something as simple as sort of like a, maybe a little paragraph about your direction and a few visual references. And sometimes they're needing a fully fleshed out director's treatment with a full plan for the development of the piece. And those treatments take time and money to create. So you kind of, you want to know first what the stakes are, like how big is this project that you're pitching for? Is it worth it? And what you're up against before you really dive in.
This is one of these episodes where the more we start talking, the more I realize we could probably go for hours. I mean, there's so many things that we haven't even touched on here. Like, I mean, yeah, even just going back to the ambition of the project in terms of, because what we're seeing a lot of now is like, you know, people are starting with these kind of smaller campaigns and they just grow and grow and grow as they kind of get successful. So it's like this whole idea of like, yeah, it's not like people are investing upfront on this kind of media buy where like, okay, we're going hard, we're doing, it's going on TV. It's like, well, we might put it on Snapchat and then all of a sudden it gets huge. It's like, okay, now it's going here. Now it's going to be a TV ad. It's kind of growing in this inverse kind of way, which is really interesting. Oh man, yeah, it's but that all comes back down to budget in terms of and a million other things. I have so much to say, but we do need to move on. I mean, let's kind of, Dom, this is kind of something that is a bit of a specialty of yours, and I think one of our kind of points of difference in Flutter, but really how people, you know, what we do at the pitch stage as well, a big thing, Lara, is kind of talk about our process and kind of explain how we kind of move from step to step. So, Dom, I thought you could just kind of take us through what the actual kind of process is like from the, I guess, from the time the brief is awarded to something when something is kind of on screen.
Sure. Well, you know, what are we making? Yep, we've got a brief. And it's fully detailed, has all the information we need. So I guess the first thing...
You're laughing. Is that uncommon?
You know, now the first thing obviously is to sit down and just work out actually, you know, what is this piece of communication all about? I mean, that's the first thing I engage with. I'm trying to work out what the message is and what our story is. And the best way to do that is to obviously, stage one is to engage with the script. And if there isn't a script, embark on script development because there's usually a kernel of a campaign idea or a concept at play. And, you know, you really want to work out what are we saying? How should we say it? All of these different things. And process-wise, all of our team are really skilled at trying to examine that question, you know, working out on one hand how we visualize it, who might be the artists that we want to work with? Who are the kind of people that are most suited to, you know, working with this this kind of question? How would we communicate this? And I think when you're doing that, you want to think about how strongly can we deliver the message for the agency. So we're always looking to invest in how we can make the meanings deeper, because you want to connect with the emotion, not just the kind of literal information that's in a script. I think once we've kind of moved through a script development stage, we move on to sketch storyboarding. So and it's almost hand in hand, because, you know, all of our team can draw. And everybody's always doodling and starting to visualize it almost immediately in very rough kind of concepts, what scenes might be, you know, how one sentence connects to another, thinking about transitions, thinking about how you can create greater meaning out of combining both image and word, etc., spoken word. And we start developing sketch storyboards, and they're a great kind of tool for everyone involved, because you can share that with clients really early on. You can share it with the other collaborators in the project, producers, sound designers, composers, and of course the artists, and really start to kind of map out the project at large. And you can see the flow, and that's really great. It's really important for a time-based medium, because you start to actually see on paper, oh, okay, I see the size of this thing. I see the scale of it. I can understand how much artwork is going to be required. I can start to get a sense of the heavier, more complicated scenes, the simpler scenes, etc. And there really is a kind of invisible set of scales that we kind of apply when we're kind of conjuring the sketch storyboards, because we're very aware of the resources at the disposal of the project. And so inherently, we're looking for that ebb and flow of how you can shine and make more detailed moments in the film where it counts, where it's necessary, and then other areas where you can pull back and be restrained. And again, it's about being really efficient with the budget at your disposal. So once we can rough out the story, I guess then the next stage is where even more people get involved, and that would be keyframe storyboards. You know, the art of the keyframe really is something of for perfectionists, really, because what you're trying to do is kind of capture in a static moment all of the sense of timing and movement that inherently might be in animation. So we're always looking to kind of create storyboard keyframes that like they've been stolen from the final piece of work. And the more accurate you can be, the better people respond.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're really just trying to get across, like, a, you know, what the final spot is going to look like without actually going through the motion of animating everything and getting that signed off.
Absolutely.
This is my favorite part. This is like when things really kind of start to feel real, and yeah, you get that motion blur happening.
Exactly.
As well.
We work with the artists, we work internally with the teams, and we start to combine all of the elements so that, you know, we really have this picture perfect view, you know, what you see is what you get type thing of the project. And it's also a very pragmatic way of approaching the project by developing style frames, keyframes, because you can share those with agency and client, etc. They can see exactly where the project is going, and you can really at that point make alterations, significant alterations, in a very cost-effective way before you move into production. So it's a highly crucial stage, and we really want to arrive at a point where we have a full set of keyframes, all the key moments in the story that are visually kind of signed off and approved. You've dealt with all of the art direction. You've dealt with all of the content. It's all there. Nothing is missing. And then you're ready to actually move on to stage two, which is really the production and the animation.
And I guess with all of these stages, it's important to reiterate that I guess the idea is that you are building on it incrementally. So, like, once something is signed off, you want to then be working on the next stage.
Exactly.
Not flitting back and forward.
Totally. The worst thing is to obviously be in a position where you're having to revise any of the foundation work. And, you know,
it's like trying to redo the foundations of your house once you've already built on top of it.
Exactly. We use that analogy of architects and, you know, storyboards, sketch storyboards and keyframes are the architect's blueprints. Once that's done. You know, really, we're moving into building. No one likes to hear once you're kind of building a house that actually you've decided you want to add in a second story. Obviously, it's possible. Yeah, but you're going to have to go back to the drawing board to make those things work. So, you know, being efficient, working with that. Obviously, you want to be really flexible. And I think this is kind of the other thing that over the years, I think we've, you know, we really try to bring to Flutter is our ability to be flexible. And when things change for unforeseen circumstances kind of arise, you know, you really want to be able to, how do we go backwards in our process? So I guess at least knowing where you've come from, you can always, you know, stop and revise and go backwards in some of the steps to kind of account for unexpected things. Maybe things were missing from the brief, or maybe, you know, something's occurred and inexplicably you have to change. But
so what happens once you get into actual production?
Production, we move, so obviously we take our approved storyboards, which is signed off, and the first thing we start to do is work out the tempo. Hopefully by that stage we've got a music guide, we might have a VO guide, and these things are really dictating and driving the tempo of the piece. We would then start to cut an animatic, or what we like to fondly refer to as a boardomatic, where we take the storyboards and literally just hard cut them against the music or the VO so that they form a really good timing bed. And the purpose to do that is to really save ourselves really important time, so that we're not dedicating animation hours to crafting specific parts that might not make the final cut. So we really want to kind of get a good overview of how things should be timed out.
And this is where we, you know, less experienced producers need to understand this is not an animation preview, which has happened on occasion where people look at the boardomatic or animatic and be like, where's all the things like that are supposed to be happening?
This isn't what I paid for.
So we definitely, those sort of things can be turned around really quickly, and we can work out in a very efficient manner. How long does an end frame need to be up, or how long does this particular scene, how important is it to the agency or to the client? And those things can be identified, and they can be sorted out really quickly at the head of animation production. Then we launch into animation, and I guess animation, depending on the different techniques, the different sort of specialized elements that are coming into play, we start to kind of attack that. Now, if the project's got live action, obviously there's a whole component there. If a project has 3D animation, there's a process there. If it's 2D animation, cell animation, stop motion, so many different things come into play. But realistically, we start incrementally developing the animation so that we work towards little milestones of work in progress presentations for our clients, so we can really step them through and show them the development of the animation. No one should be really shocked or surprised when they're seeing this kind of come together, because the storyboards and the keyframes are so exacting that really it's this fantastic magical stage where everybody starts kind of like, you know, feeling relieved, because actually everything you've worked to this point is now coming to life. And so we're really building the bridges between those static keyframes, and that's what the animation is about, process is about, is defining those moments in between the keyframes.
Awesome.
And then hold on, once the actual, everything's in motion, they love it, the end technical bit, they're actually rendering everything out. What happens? No one ever seems to understand this bit, and it's sort of often a bit that...
Shh, we do not speak.
Rendering, animation, all of those things obviously depend on the scale of the project and the time. We've just started work on an IMAX project, which will be insane. It's stereoscopic, so it's true 3D. But the scale of this thing is ridiculous. It's 5.6K, plus it's minimum 16-bit. So the data you're talking about is extraordinary. This is super nerdy, and I hate talking about this stuff.
You're in a room full of nerds, don't worry.
But, you know, rendering for that stuff is insane. And, you know, rendering is often a kind of black art, because it really depends on the processes at play. You might render one pass, which represents one layer in Photoshop, for instance. So you might end up with a project that has 12 passes that all have to be individually rendered on their own. Then you need to take those passes and you need to recompose them in a program, then render them again. So, you know, it's like cooking, you know, sometimes the complexity can actually just be, you know, extraordinary. Some recipes take 10 minutes to whip up. Yeah, others take half an hour to an hour.
I was going to say, on top of that, you've then got the magic, the dark art of compression.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, we have, I mean, there's so much in post-production, where, you know, we haven't even talked about grading or anything like that, which, you know, definitely sometimes happens on certain jobs. And yeah, compression for output, all that stuff. But yeah, I think that's a really good kind of top line overview. You know, Bianca, as someone who's working this for kind of so long and been across all those steps, you'll know that it's not always kind of that easy to get from, you know, point A to be along that line. So to wrap us up here, I mean, just let's go through a bit more of some of the specific, you know, some of the specific challenges that you see kind of happen along those stages and how you kind of have dealt with them.
Yeah, I mean, Dom just touched on the biggest one in terms of, you know, rendering. You know, compared to sort of other projects, like an animation commission is just so much bigger. So scale is one of the biggest challenges when you're working in animation. You know, instead of just working with one artist, you're working with a team of people to realize something that's more complex. You know, you're instead of focusing on one image, you're often managing, you know, 30, 60, 90, couple of minutes worth of images across, you know, a more complex story and a number of deliverables and bigger egos, freelance resources, other external suppliers like sound houses and voice artists. So there are a lot more parts that need to come together to successfully produce an animated project. And that, you know, that kind of has implications across sort of every part of the process. And I think number one, the thing that makes animation so unique is that, you're dealing with an added level of storytelling, which is a lot more open to interpretation. You know, a client will sometimes choose to commission animation rather than, you know, live action, because with animation, you know, you're able to bend reality. So the possibilities are endless, but budgets and resources are most definitely not. They're finite. So, you know, we start with just words on the page. It's then up to the animation director. So it's up to Dom to take responsibility to take that script and develop a treatment which shows how they intend to see the story panning out over the spot's duration. And that's something that is often compressed into 3 days, 5 days at most, you know, to put a treatment together. And, you know, if something's more character-based, you know, essentially the animation director is coming up with an entire world for these characters to exist in. And, you know, they're there to help, as we've spoken about, like set the pace, the energy and the emotion. And on top of that, when considering like how they're actually going to bring something to life, the director is then responsible also for working alongside the producer and their team to decide on the best technical approach to actually execute this animation based on what they have available, you know, time-wise and budget-wise, and then to then present and negotiate this with the client. I think Dom's touched on it a bit before, but animation can involve a lot of compromises in order to actually balance the time and the budget and the creative to get the most successful results. So it really does involve having a really intimate understanding of what's possible, especially from a technical point of view, as well as maintaining strong relationships with your freelance resources and being able to bring them in, have people across multiple skill levels and disciplines that you can call upon when you need them, you know, to turn around something in such a short amount of time. And I think the kind of interesting thing for me is that animation definitely brings up some interesting interpersonal challenges just because of the size and the scale. You know, I think it's shifting a little bit in recent years, but TV spots have traditionally always been where a client invests the biggest media spend for their product or campaign. So the expectations on the production company in terms of, you know, the level of service and the quality of execution can definitely be up there, and the stakeholders that are involved from the agency and the client side because of that are generally at the top of the food chain and, you know, have limited availability to sit down and review work in progress, which means that there's often more pressure on a schedule and there's less room to be flexible and to be agile. And you know, when things come up that, you know, when a render doesn't work, you know, you have to allow in the production process a lot more buffer for to be able to actually allow for, you know, the kind of like complexity of animation, which takes a lot of time. What I think is really interesting for me for animation is the stakes are a lot higher because you're dealing with a lot more components, the moving parts that, you know, can have a real waterfall effect once things start to move around. So I think the one of the most important things when kind of like kicking off an animation project is to really have an open line of communication between the agency and the production company. That's absolutely paramount. I mean, animation, it's complex, it's expensive, and it's not expensive, but it's like there are like quite large hard costs involved. And
it's expensive because every kind of second of content requires lots of people touching it, and the more people touch something, the more expensive it is.
I think that's a really good point about the teamwork. I think, you know, you can't be explicit enough about how important it is to form a relationship with the agency and the client and the production company, and those open lines of communication where you're constantly updating each other as the sands shift. And really kind of, you know, we said before, it's theatre, it's such a collaborative art. You really need to be across every aspect, both creative and technical, so that you can really stay with the pace of a project, which can, you know, turn on its head at any particular moment.
Yeah, definitely. And I think because animation often goes, you know, it runs over sometimes a number of months. Like, I think an agency or a client really wants to trust that the production company, you know, is actually going to be able to execute their vision, but also like actually just have the assurance that they're entering in a partnership with someone that they're going to enjoy working with and who are flexible and open to their ideas, but, you know, also confident in their own and, you know, their ability to problem solve and, you know, have technical prowess, because, you know, we're kind of like you're trying to create a world that doesn't exist and execute it in a really short amount of time. And that's like, oh God, that's what I love about it. But it does take a lot of planning. I just want to quickly touch on planning. I mean, every tiny shift in scope, delay in feedback, whatever it is, it's going to be costly. So I think the role of a producer is so important. And, you know, it's so important to have someone that is closely monitoring the project to ensure that things don't fall through the cracks and it all remains on schedule and the client is guided on what they can expect at each stage, and, you know, knows what we want from them in terms of feedback and improvements. And on that note, I think it's helpful to be, you know, to be a client as well that understands the animation process as best as they can. And, or, you know, if they haven't, you know, don't have as much experience in it, just be curious about the process and open to asking as many questions as they need so that they can confidently present any animation work in progress to their client. Yeah, and just technical, like super Zen frames, lockups, PAL, NDSC. Like, there's so many words that come up in animation that, yeah, it's a different beast.
Well, it's a beast that brings together so many of the previous things that we've spoke about. So, yeah, I think everything that we spoke about in some way over the last kind of 25 episodes definitely kind of comes into play here. So we only scratch the surface in some ways, but I think we'll post them kind of links to some of the businesses and things that we've talked about in our show notes. But otherwise, we'll wrap it for now. So, Dom, thank you so much for coming in.
Hey, pleasure.
Closing as we like to every week, going over some of the most Melbourne and most New York things that have happened to us this week. Dom, I think you're going to be my proxy today for someone who never has any Melbourne stuff. And you, well, we were talking this before recording, you mentioned some talk of a robot.
Yeah.
Which sounds like a very Melbourne thing.
This thing has been brewing for some time. It's
that's our third pun today.
Yeah. Underneath our studio, there was a commercial shop front and it was empty for some time. And then one day we saw this black curtain get erected. And we're like, what's going on? Someone's moving in. And then we saw a logo go up and van with the same logo appeared. And this van had the title oncealike.com. Printed on it, right? The site is not live yet. So,
Say Jeremy and I like straight away typing.
Yeah, totally into your computers. Anyway, I was like so intrigued and I was trying to get a look inside the shop and we saw this logo and it kind of looked like a yogurt thing. Like it was
it's
like
always this, a yogurt thing.
There's drippy and we were all taking guesses as to what it was. Anyway, eventually we were digitally stalking the guy who is behind it and he's actually got a coding background and he's developed several apps. Interesting guy, and we found a Twitter account where he had posted some mysterious photos of a factory. And in this factory, in these black and white shots, like right in the corner, you could see there was like this robot arm. And I was like, I joked with our staff. I was like, hey, maybe he's like doing a robo cafe, and we all had a laugh. But lo and behold, when the curtain was like slightly ajar one day, we saw inside the shop front and there is a total robot barista being set up. And it's like got several arms and it will totally make you coffee. I think it's just a really elaborate vending machine at the end of the day.
That's what it sounds like.
But I'm not sure what the quality of the coffee will be like, but I'm absolutely positive with his background. There must be an app associated with it that you can like pre-order your coffee or something. Or I just want it to like say, good morning, Dom. And like talk to me in a robot voice.
I can
when
say
I
that to you, Dom, when yeah? I call you.
Anything that cuts down on human interaction in my day is fine by me.
God, that's so depressing, Jeremy.
I think it's sacrilegious in Melbourne to have a robot cafe.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah, yes, totally agree. Definitely. Lara?
Melbourne. So we had a very like, I mean, I don't want to say non-eventful because I think in like regional Victoria, the storms and flood warnings were like very realistic. There was some pretty horrendous damage caused. So that is sad. But in Melbourne, in sort of big city Melbourne, where all these slickers are like us, the rain was like, there were all these giant warnings for rain and it was very nothing. Nothing really happened. There were a lot of jokes about it. But my favorite thing was, as always, when it rains a bit, underpasses, under bridges sort of will flood a little bit. And there's one in Footscray that floods all the time. It has for my entire life. And someone drove their Maserati into the floodwaters. And there are these awesome photos of the Maserati, like, sitting, absolutely add it to the podcast.
I can't wait to look at this.
Oh my God. It's like sitting sort of half deep into the flood. Like clearly they've sort of looked at it and gone like, yeah, I reckon I can make that. And just gone halfway in. And obviously like air's been cut off to the engine and it's just like stopped. It's stuck there.
I love your Maserati owner voice.
Yeah, that's what they all sound like. I know many of them, Dom. I run in very fancy circles. And like there's even photos of the inside, like the whole inside of the car is flooded.
Oh, and devastating.
Like, it was stuck there for hours and just everyone from the area, which like is Footscray, which is inherently like anti-stupid rich people, was just like taking photos of the car and it was amazing.
Oh, that's so great. Look, I traveled to Williamsport, Pennsylvania over the weekend for Thanksgiving, which is best known as the home of Little League Baseball, and it's kind of relatively rural. It was beautiful. It was surrounded by mountains. I could literally see wild deer from the bathroom window. But it was a real eye-opening look at the other America, which is not New York or Los Angeles. And
whoa.
You mean there's other parts?
Wow.
Yeah, there's more to America than meets the eye. To get there, I took a bus from Manhattan, which was about an hour and a half to the Poconos. And then from the Poconos, we drove for another hour and a half to Williamsport. And my favorite thing while on the road was this sign in the middle of nowhere that said, Manhattan food, 1 mile. I don't know what that is. Like, is that a bagel? Is that a dollar pizza? Jeremy, what do you reckon?
I have no idea. Maybe it's the name of a location called Manhattan Mile. I mean, Manhattan food. I have no idea. No, Manhattan Mile. Now I'm confusing words. I have no idea. Don't know. I've been here for too long. I'm completely the American.
You're Australian, mate.
I'm Australian, mate. Okay. Thank you, B.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Arij Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. Archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/JackieWinter. If you love what you hear, you can help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and give us a review. Details are on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. You can also sign up to our weekly podcast-specific newsletter at tinyletter.com/JackieWinter to get all the show notes and episode release notification in your inbox every Friday. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye-bye.